Welcome back to the NHL Executive Suite. I'm Deb Placey, and our guest today is Kim Davis, who is the Executive Vice President of Social Impact for the National Hockey League, one of the most interesting and most important hires that the league has made in the last couple of years. Just to give you a little background on Kim, she was highly successful in the corporate world for many years, including 20 years at JP Morgan Chase. She was named by Essence magazine as one of the most influential black women in America, alongside Michelle Obama, among others. And she has made a big impact already on the NHL. So thank you so much, Kim, for coming today. We've been really excited to have you on.
Well, thank you.
The first thing I saw, I'm sure it's the first thing a lot of people see when they start to learn a little bit about you, is about your grandmother. Oh. And that she was not only one of the first black women to go to Harvard, but the first black woman to get a PhD from Harvard. So how did she get to Harvard? That's my first question for you.
Well, she was just a trailblazer in so many ways. So she did her undergraduate work at the University of Rhode Island. Is probably a better question. How did she end up at the University of Rhode Island?
Okay,
right?
So go ahead.
Her family history goes back to the Boston, Rhode Island area, surprisingly. A history of a family that came out of slavery. She was one of three girls. They were all accomplished, two of them PhDs, my grandmother being one of the two, and the third one had two masters. My grandmother was the only one that was married of the three, so they call them the Spinster Sisters. And she married my grandfather, who was a Baptist minister in North Carolina, and everyone says that he made her a kinder, gentler person. So she went on from University of Rhode Island to Harvard. So she's a Northeast girl.
How did she meet your grandfather if he was in North Carolina?
Met through a church affiliation. There was, you can imagine that during that time back in the 20s and the 30s, a small network of educated black people, and he had gone to North Carolina State, and so they met at some kind of church event.
So to come from where your grandmother was coming from, how is it that, the generation above, her parents' generation, how was she and your aunts, her sisters, able to get to college and to be educated?
As I have thought about the conversations that I've had with her before she passed, which was 1986, she didn't really talk a lot about the experience of getting to college, and she didn't really like to talk so much about the experience of being there. She talked about the work that she did to help others feel comfortable after her in going there. And so there is a dormitory on the campus of University of Rhode Island named in her honor because of the work that she did at URI. So she was more about the future, not about the past. And I think there were probably some painful moments associated with her experience.
It could not have been all easy.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't at all.
Have there been times for you now, two more generations removed, that have not been easy as you've made your path?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I grew up in Chicago, and grew up in the 60s, so you can imagine that was still during the height of the civil rights movement, and so there are many moments that I can look to, but I often thought about what my grandmother went through in the 30s and really never complained about anything that I was going through, because it wasn't anything compared to what she had obviously experienced. And both on my mother and my father's side, we just have had a history of sort of fearless women who have really been very positive in not just focusing on what the past experience was, but really thinking about opportunities, not obstacles. And so that's really been my pathway, more opportunities and not obstacles.
What's the common ground you find in fearless women, whether it's in your family or those that you've met along the way?
My grandmother, my mother's mother, who was not college educated but was probably one of the smartest women I know, her name was Beatrice, would often say to me that fearless doesn't mean that you don't fear. It means that you accept and acknowledge fear and that you move on beyond it. And so I think that's one of the core tenets of being fearless, is to understand that you understand fear is part of it, and yet you have to move beyond your fear. And I've taught my kids that. I speak about that when I speak to women, because I think often we stand in our own way because we think, maybe I can't do that. And so even my transition from financial services and consulting into hockey, a sport that I didn't grow up with, a sport that I didn't have any experience with, even an industry that I'd never worked in, is an example of taking some risk and understanding that your skills and competencies probably count more than the industries that you've been in.
So not to be paralyzed by fear.
Not to be paralyzed by fear, I think, is really important.
How did you get started with the NHL?
So I was with a consulting firm, Teneo, that did a project for the NHL, and I led that project, and it was helping the NHL look at all of its social assets and to think about how to make them more community and forward-facing. Had a chance to meet the commissioner. We had some deep and rich conversations about his thoughts and vision for the next 100 years of the sport. The centennial was just being celebrated. And so I think from that project, and obviously his exposure to me and our conversations, he decided to create this position, which is a newly created position, bringing together all of the assets around community and government and youth hockey and inclusion to really represent what our league's view of the future might look like.
So from what I've read, you were doing some interviews, right? Almost, you know, consulting.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're smiling. So who did you interview, and what kind of things did you ask them? What were you trying to find out, really, as intel, right, for the NHL, for hockey?
Yeah.
As they try to move forward, what were some of the things you asked, and what did you learn about the game and about the league before you came here?
So what I think what's sort of funny is I originally was supposed to only interview 15 people. I think I ended up interviewing 40 people, because after every interview, apparently the person would go and say, you ought to talk to her. It was a really right. interesting conversation. And so
they
would keep adding to the list of people to talk to. But some of the questions I asked were, you know, what's your view of how hockey is going to grow in the future? How do you think audiences outside of hockey perceive the sport of hockey? What are the barriers to growth in the sport? What can we do better to amplify and tell the stories of players? So just stories that really got to the core and the essence of, you know, what the sport is, what the culture of the sport is, and how that culture can be better understood for new audiences, but really strengthening and deepening the relationship with both casual and avid fans. And what I learned was remarkable. One is I realized I had my own preconceived notions about the sport. And so I figured if I had those notions, probably a lot of people that weren't consuming the sport had them too. And that really has been a big part of what has driven how we are thinking about ways to reach new audiences. Secondly, I think that there are so many barriers to the sport that don't exist for other sports that we have to really be intentional about breaking them down. So I categorized after that assignment sort of the three broad areas of barriers, one being infrastructure, just access to ice, where ice is, the how the physical plants are deteriorating in so many parts of North America, how municipalities don't have the funding to actually fix a lot of these structures, and what we can do and partner with organizations to help with that. Two is economic. Just the cost of the sport is expensive. It's not just a ball and, you know, going outside and play. It's equipment, it's helmet, it's ice time. And for so many communities, particularly where ice might not be prevalent, this is an expensive cost. And then the third, and I think it equally as important, are the cultural barriers. You know, who have been the consumers of the sport in the past? How can we ensure that we are being intentional as a sport and making the sport welcoming, which doesn't mean just putting programs out there, but really going out and building trust with these new communities?
So we'll definitely get to the first two, and I know that the NHL, including under your leadership, has done a lot of things to address those. one of the most interesting things to me, if not the most interesting, of the work that you've done is the concept that you came up with, that it's quite a tribal sport. Mm-hmm. And that one of those barriers culturally is for those who already belong and are fans of a team, they're all in, they're so passionate about it. But sometimes someone new to the sport thinks they don't belong. They're sort of outside the tribe. So it makes those who are in it ever more passionate, yet it's hard to join or to feel accepted. Yeah. Is that something you've been, you know, how have you been working on that, I guess is the question.
Yeah. And I say that with the utmost respect, because I think the powerful attributes of a tribe is that when you're in it, it really is so welcoming and so inclusive. But as you pointed out, often when you're on the outside, you don't know what it takes and how you actually enter it. And I can really appreciate that feeling, having grown up in a industry like financial services, where often I was the only female, and more often than not, the only person of color. And I can remember going to Davos one year and walking into the hotel, and I was in casual clothing, and, you know, people that I'd worked with, you know, sort of out of context, and so didn't know me, and how that made me feel like maybe I just want to go upstairs and put my pajamas on and get in the bed. And when I got upstairs, there were flowers there with a note from my husband saying, I know you want to go to bed, put your bath suit on and get down there. And so it was, no one was excluding me from anything,
right,
but no one was including me either.
Right.
And I think that's the difference. I don't think there's any intentionality on anyone's part to be exclusionary. I just think it takes real intention to be inclusive, which means you have to do the reaching out. And I think that's what we are learning that we have to do in our sport to break down some of the stereotypes about it being tribal, is that we have to do more outreach. And not expect groups to do in-reaching.
Right, right. So what have you done? What can you do? What are some concrete things that we can see?
So one of the things that we're doing, which has been very exciting over the past couple of months, are what we're calling lunch and learns. And we've now done these in three communities, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and St. Louis. And what we've done is we've identified influencers and thought leaders in those communities alongside with the clubs in those areas. In St. Louis, we had about 50 influencers. In Philadelphia, we had about 30. And in Washington, we had close to 30, 40. Women, from the Hispanic, from the African-American community, from the Asian community, from communities that have been under-indexed in our sport. And it's really been not only an opportunity for us to talk about what we're doing in the sport, which is always incredibly educational and informational, but more importantly than that, for us to be good listeners and to understand from those communities what we can do to have those communities feel more included. And the learning has been fascinating. I've heard in all three locations that community leaders left there saying this was one of the most transparent and authentic dialogues. We now understand more about the sport. We understand more about how our particular groups are currently consuming, but as importantly, how we can get from a grassroots all the way up more connectivity with the sport. So we're going to continue to do those.
And you were saying that you were pretty new to the sport when you took on the job, even after the consulting.
Right.
Are you knee-deep now in, you know, all things hockey, and you recognize offsides when you see it, and icing? And
well, I'm not going to say I'm any expert, but I've been to more than 18 games. So I think, you know, once you consume the sport of hockey, once you go to your first live game, you really are hooked, and I mean that sincerely. Coming from a sports family, I mean, I grew up around baseball and basketball and football, never around hockey. But I come from a sports background. I played tennis in high school. Both of my kids played sports. But when you see the sport on the ice, it really is quite something, and you do get hooked.
I have to say, so I covered the game and broadcast it on TV for I don't know, 25 years and was never afraid to say, no offense to those of us who do TV, but TV doesn't do it justice.
Oh, it doesn't. I mean, it really doesn't.
Unfortunately for those of us who worked at TV for a long time, but it is true.
Yeah.
If you are at the live game and you, you know, talk to people who have gone for the first time, the ice is so small, the guys are so big, it's powerful, it's fast, and you lose a little bit of that on
You do. You really do.
So I do understand that, and yeah. it's true.
Yeah. No, I really enjoy the games, and you know, every time I visit a club, I obviously go to a game.
Right. Right.
So it's really been quite fun.
You know, this is just something that I've thought of over the years in terms of learning the game. I do think that there has been an issue with in terms of thinking that everybody knows the rules and everybody knows hockey. And sometimes when you're watching a game, maybe we shouldn't be afraid to point out, you know, what icing is or what offsides is for any, you know, you want to include people who are watching and can't assume that everyone's an expert who is tuning in.
Yeah. There's a club that's piloting a program called First Look. And it engages new audiences to come to the game, but they invite them to come an hour before the game, and they actually go in and they sit down and they take them through some of the basic fundamentals of the game. So, but by the time they get into the stadium, they actually know a little bit about the game. And to your point, I think it just increases the level of comfort so enormously. Because now they understand a little bit about the terminology, and so they don't feel so alien to the sport. So I think that that's going to really take off in a lot of clubs. I've been talking about this, particularly for new audiences. But I think you're right. That's part of how you really create that welcoming environment for people to really understand more about the sport.
What have some of your reactions or interactions, I should say, been with the players since you've started?
All positive. We had a really great experience back in December where we brought the Black Girls Hockey Club, and that's just a fascinating story. So a young woman by the name of Marlene Hess, who's the founder of Black Girls Hockey, who's been a hockey avid, a college professor living in California, and had an online connection with other women across the country who love the sport, who are avids, but for whatever reason may not have ever gone to a live game, either because they felt like they were the only one, or they felt isolated, or they didn't have anybody to go with. So they created this network, but they had never gone to a game together. So she and I connected on LinkedIn, and I got excited about it. So We worked to have their first game be with the Washington Caps, and the Caps were really excited about hosting them. So they had about 50 of their members from all over the country come to Washington, and we made an entire weekend of it. Started with a Friday visit to the Smithsonian African American Museum, and then the Caps hosted them. They had dinner for them, just did a big deal around it. And that was a really great opportunity to interface with the players, and the players were so excited to have them there. Devontae was there, but not just the Black players,
right.
All the players, and they were gracious and they were humble, as we typically hear about the players being. And so that is an example of how gracious the players were and how appreciative they were that these women had come and had come to the Caps game. Every interaction that I've had with the players has really been very positive, and they are so regular. Now, when you think about Uber sports folks, you know, often they get a bad rap about being egotistical and unapproachable. That is not the case in my experience with hockey players.
For sure. Okay, so then the four little words that we heard, shut up and dribble, a little while ago, and that somehow in society we want opinions from players, but maybe only if they agree with ours. Where do you see the NHL in that whole breakdown of your players having a voice and being heard, being on the right side of it, you know, and then sometimes others don't want to hear from them, which, you know, maybe neither here nor there. How do you feel about it?
Yeah. I think that first we have to understand our sport within the context of culture. And so for sure it is just a cultural part of our sport and our players to be, as I just described, very humble and maybe in some cases many might even be shy. And so we've not been a sport of individuals, we've been a sport of team. And so the concept of stand out has just not been part of the culture of the sport. Now, having said that, we do know that we are now in an age with millennials and Gen Z where they are going to consume sport based on their affinity with a player versus a team. That's data. And so how do we find the appropriate blend and mix between the humility and the team sport orientation of hockey and getting players comfortable with being more socially aware, meaning social media aware, and comfortable, because that is going to help with the stickiness of our fan base long term, particularly as we think about new generations. And I think everybody is very aware of that. I think everyone understands the business case for that. And I feel comfortable that we're going to get there.
I have heard you say that you do appreciate from the players that it's not just sort of lip service like the Capitals. They really were excited, and it wasn't just Devonte Smith-Pelly. It was all of the team. They were as into it as he was. And some of those who have been out front, Braden Holtby, who happens to be a Capital, on Pride Night, that you are in favor of that, and you like that, and do you feel like the players have handled it well so far, I guess is my question.
Yeah, I think.
Or do you need more from them?
Well, I think that, again, it goes back to the appropriate balance and the evolution of this. It's going to be it's going to evolve. It's not going to be a revolution, right? It's going to be an evolution. And so I think that that's only fair and appropriate. I think we have the appropriate attention on this and the resources against it. You know, the work that we've done over the past 2 years in the social media front and the work that Heidi Browning is doing to educate and to provide training for players and for team leadership around why this is important and the data associated with this, the generational data that I just referred to and the attributes and attitudes of those generations. So I think that players are getting more comfortable. I think every year, so I've only been here 15 months, but I've seen the data over the past 2 years with the comfort level of the players. And I think it's increasing and improving. And as younger generations of players come in, they're going to be more comfortable with it because they've been consuming this as part of who they are. So I think we're going to get there, and I think we're getting there.
In addition to being lauded by many, the Business Journal's 100 Most Influential Women, I like how Fast Company names you one of the 100 most creative people in business. What makes you creative? What's the creative side of you?
Oh, well, that was quite an honor, and that was for a specific initiative that I did when I was at JPMorgan Chase. But I think what makes me creative, I hope, is the ability to really think about what the future looks like and to be a real advocate for preparing for the future now as opposed to waiting to when the future is upon us. And I think I've probably always been like that. My grandfather used to say I was an old soul, so this is probably something that's in my DNA and goes way back. But I love change.
Now, most people are afraid of change.
I know. And so that's one of the things that makes me creative and maybe a little different and maybe even odd, is that I embrace it and I actually get a kick out of leading change efforts. I really enjoy that. So if I look at the thread through my career, whether it be from when I started as a financial analyst to, you know, when I was in the strategy group at J.P. Morgan to when I was in human resources, in every role, and they've been varied and different, I've embraced it. I've wanted to be in a place where there was maybe confusion and ambiguity, and I could bring order to that. And so that's really been the the core tenet throughout my career is being a change agent.
Although you might be an old soul, it does sound like your son, who's along the family line of getting a PhD and is also, I hear, doing a podcast, he seems to be an influence, though, in terms of looking toward the future. What do millennials and Gen Xers want? Which I know the NHL, like all companies, wants to please and wants to bring in. So how does he influence what you're trying to do here?
Yeah, I have two millennials, and they are 6 years apart. My daughter is older than my son, who's 26.
So wait, how old do you have to be a millennial? Like, what's the... I don't know.
I think the ages are 23 to, like, 37.
Okay.
Yeah, so they both are in that sphere. And I learn and have learned so much by raising them, but as adults, being around them and listening to them and their friends talk about things in all areas of industry, whether it be sports or politics or whatever. And yeah, that's really influenced my point of view on a lot of things. It's been a great focus group. It really has.
So you have your own consulting firm
at home.
I have
my own consulting firm. Neither of them lives at home, but boy, we spend a lot of time together and we're a close-knit family. So I really do appreciate the different point of views and the fact that we can debate, and we do debate a lot, particularly my son and I, because he really is a big thinker and a scholar and a cultural anthropologist, and so he really studies the business of people and speaks five languages, and so
wow.
He can do it in so many different ways. And so, yeah, I learned a lot from him.
That's amazing. What do you find, and what are you finding that the next generation of NHL fans wants? And, you know, and when I say fans, I mean parents and kids who buy jerseys and pay for tickets and watch the broadcasts. You know, your consumers, really.
Yeah. So, let me start backwards, and let me start with millennials as parents, because what we now know is that millennials have come of age, that 30-something top end of millennials, and they are now becoming parents. And so there's a lot of data around this, but forget the data, just experientially, and again, being around so many millennials because of my kids, they are really socially conscious. They want to associate with brands that are purpose-driven. They want to know that the things that they're exposing their kids to, their children to, embrace multiculturalism because they are multicultural. They're more mixed race kids and adults in the millennial population, and even more in the upcoming Gen Z than in any previous generation that we've seen. They will associate with brands more for purpose than maybe even for the strength of the brand product. So these are really, really important things for us to understand as a sport. They also want ease of consumption. They are busy, typically both parents working, and so they want to associate with activities that make it easy for them, whether it be access to scheduling through technology, ways in which you can carpool. So all the things that maybe one in an area like sport might say, that's not something we need to worry about. That's something we have to be thinking about, because that's how they're going to consume our sport.
They can get Uber home from the game. They might come.
Exactly. And it may not be a mom at the game. It may, you know, this construct of parents are different today, right? There are a lot of dads that stay home and moms that are the breadwinners. And so all of our preconceived notions and our historical norms around what family looks like and how families operate and what they want, we really have to suspend judgment if we're going to grow our sport.
Interesting. So that's sort of the millennials who are now becoming parents. How about the next generation of young fans and how they're able to interact on social media with their heroes, with the players,
yeah,
with the coaches? you know, see, feel, touch, open practices, those kinds of things? You feel like those things make a difference?
I think they all make a difference. And we know the core of all of that for the next generation is going to be technology. They may not consume the sport in the stadium the same way that we've seen historical generations. They may come to the stadium, but they may want to actually consume the sport on their mobile devices. Gaming is going to be critically important. We already see that in sport. And so, and not just being isolated gaming, group gaming, and our ability to facilitate that both inside the stadiums and outside the stadiums, it will really be important. Women. The girls and how we present our messaging to girls. Girls is strong and bold and powerful is the way girls want to be marketed to, particularly in this generation. And so, again, we have to really break down our historical norms and stereotypes around girls and women if we're going to really attract in a big way that audience. And by the way, women represent $7 trillion in buying power, and women will support sports that they both play and they see girls being treated the right way in. And so these are all considerations that we have to take into account as we think about our sport.
Now, what do you like to do if you have time to do when you're not working?
Resting, no. I enjoy spending time with my family. I enjoy interior design.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah.
I love that.
So
sort
that's
sort of an odd mix, right?
Yeah, it
but
is.
It takes,
but
you know,
it's a little
all
bit
kinds.
Of a little bit it takes all kinds. I enjoy reading. I do more podcast listening now, which is a way for me to consume a lot of information. Spending time with my husband. I'm very active with my church, so I have a wide variety of interests, and I try to really, when I have downtime, I really like it to be private time.
What does your husband think about this gig of yours?
So my husband is a lawyer by training, and he thinks it's pretty cool. He's always been amazed at the agility in which my career has operated and moved, being a lawyer and being very sequential in how he thinks and views the world. So I always say my children, my daughter's a lawyer by training. She's more like my husband, and my son is more of the creative type. So, yeah, he's somewhere closer to my end. But, yeah, my husband has been my greatest cheerleader and my greatest supporter throughout my career. So he's just always there.
That's great. I have to say that be the change you wish to see in the world is my favorite quote. And I so admire women and folks like you who are agents of change and are on the front lines and doing things to make change. So thank you for all the work that you do. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, me too. That was Kim Davis, quite a fascinating woman, the executive vice president of social impact for the NHL. And I love the fact that she likes change, to be so willing to take a risk and try to make changes at this level in one of the major sports like the NHL is no small thing. So we're looking forward to watching her progress and so happy to have gotten a chance to chat with her. You can always download the NHL Executive Suite on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you normally get your podcasts. And if you enjoy them, if you enjoyed today's, please drop us a review. And if there's anyone else that you'd like to hear, we are happy to take suggestions. So thanks for listening, and until next time on the Executive Suite, I'm Deb Placey.